This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. Every parent has heard that horror story of a child who suddenly developed unexplained fever, vomiting or headaches, and was later found to have meningitis. Now, how do we know when some of these symptoms, which seem so benign, may point to something like meningitis, and how do we prevent it? So today I'm speaking to Dr. Sangeeta Terumale, consultant pediatrician and neurologist from Subang Jaya Medical Center, to find out more. How are you today, Dr. Sangeeta?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thank you so much for spending your time to speak to us today.
Pleasure.
I think perhaps it would be very helpful to start with understanding what exactly is meningitis and what is being affected when that develops.
So meningitis is essentially a condition where the protective layer of the brain and the spinal cord gets infected by various organisms, either bacteria or viruses. And this infection will also cause an inflammatory sort of condition over the brain. So in simple terms, meningitis is essentially an infection of the meninges, which is the protective layer of the brain and the spinal cord.
So how does the swelling of this layer affect the brain and the spinal cord, and how does it go on to affect the rest of the body as well?
Right. Okay. So, so the brain is, the brain is enveloped with the this protective layer, which is the meninges, and between the brain itself and the layer, that's what we call cerebrospinal fluid. So, when the infection, if the infection just stays on the meninges, sometimes you won't get very serious consequences. But because it's very close to the brain itself, the infection can also infect the brain tissue itself. So sometimes meningitis actually will also coexist with what we call encephalitis, which is an infection of the brain itself. So generally, we as neurologists, we like to use the term meningoencephalitis, mm-hmm. because, you know, it's the brain and the layer are too close, and sometimes we don't know whether only the layer is infected or also the brain itself. So we like to use the word meningoencephalitis.
It sounds terrifying, of course. Anything that affects the brain is really alarming when we hear about it. What happens when the brain tissue gets infected?
Okay. So, it depends which part of the brain tissue gets affected. So, for example, you know, we know that our brain is like a supercomputer of the body. It controls many functions we have. So if there is an involvement, for example, in the part of the brain which controls the way we move, what we would expect is a problem with movement or lack of movement in the child. Mm-hmm. And if the part of the brain which gets affected is, you know, where we swallow, then there'll be a swallowing problem. So it basically depends on which part it is affected. So we could get a myriad of clinical features because of meningitis and encephalitis.
Mm. So how common is meningitis among children in Malaysia?
Okay, we wish we knew, but actually we really don't know how common it is. And it's probably largely attributable to the fact that many parents don't consent for a procedure called lumbar puncture. Mm-hmm. This is an important procedure we need to do to diagnose meningitis. So we will never actually know for sure.
I see.
But there is a study published by a group of pediatricians in 1998. And this was a study in, I think, 5 centers in Malaysia. And there were 435 kids which suspected to have a diagnosis of meningitis. And only 71 of them actually had a lumbar puncture. So we really don't know, but you know, this will probably give us an idea of who may have among the admissions. And among the 71 cases, we could only get an organism in 58 of them. So this was one of the earlier studies of meningitis in Malaysia. And this prompted the inclusion of Haemophilus influenza B vaccine in 2002, because from this study, we found that a quarter of the cases which had organism isolated was a bacteria called Haemophilus influenza. So because of this study, I think one of the important studies which prompted the inclusion of this vaccination in our national immunization program in 2002.
Hmm. And apart from Haemophilus influenza B, and that's a bacteria, what are the other common types of bacteria and viruses that can cause meningitis?
Okay, so there are a few. The one which is a bit more common now would be pneumococcal infection. There was another study which was done in 2008 till 2009, but this study is unpublished. So I got this data from the investigators themselves. The reason why we couldn't publish it is because lack of, again, cerebrospinal fluid samples. So we really don't know who had meningitis for real. But in this study, they basically looked at children with pneumococcal disease, or what we call invasive pneumococcal disease. So there were 173 kids with invasive pneumococcal disease in 13 government hospitals. And 29 kids, which is about 16.8% of them, had meningitis. And from this 173 children, there were 31 deaths. And among the kids who died, 50% were due to meningitis, which were 18. So that's a significant number. So I would think that, you know, after the era of mandatory inclusion of HIB vaccination, the commonest bacteria after that would be pneumococcal.
And viral meningitis, that is also common?
Right. So I was mainly focusing on bacterial meningitis just now. So if you were to think what can cause meningitis, of course, viruses are more common cause of meningitis than bacteria. Of course, we can also get tuberculous meningitis. That means meningitis due to TB infection. We can even get meningitis due to parasites and various fungal infections. Rarely, even non-infectious causes can cause meningitis, like certain cancers and all that, leukemic infiltration of the meninges also can cause meningitis. But these are a bit more rare. So viral meningitis is still the most commonest.
All right. And of course, every virus that everyone is talking about now is SARS-CoV-2, which causes COVID-19. Is meningitis right. one of the complications in COVID-19?
Yes. I believe there have been reportable cases of COVID-19 causing meningitis. So yes, COVID-19 can cause meningitis because it is a virus, and if any virus can cause meningitis, so can COVID-19.
And we are talking about children being a vulnerable, group here. Is there any particular age group that is at highest risk of developing meningitis due to, you know, whether it's the bacteria or the viruses?
Right. So remember I quoted the study which was done in early 1998. So in that study, what we found, this is the local data, and we found that children less than 5 years old, and especially those who are less than 6 months old, are at higher risk of developing meningitis. Anybody with even poor immune response also has got a higher risk of developing this deadly infection of the brain.
All right. And at such a young age, of course, I mean, as you said, you know, things like vaccination with the HIB vaccine, pneumococcal vaccination is available, although not under the immunization schedule. I'm sure that contributes a great deal to reducing the incidence. But what parents are really concerned about is also, you know, other causes, other viruses that could lead to meningitis, and how do you know when your child has that? So we'll go for a quick break now, and when we come back, I want to ask Dr. Sangeeta, what are the symptoms that should be red flags for parents to bring their kids to the doctor if they suspect that these symptoms aren't just the common fever, cough and cold. So I'm speaking to Dr. Sangeeta Terumalay, consultant pediatrician and neurologist from Subang Jaya Medical Center, about meningitis in children. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yi. Today, I'm speaking to Dr. Sangeeta Terumalay, consultant pediatrician and neurologist from Subang Jaya Medical Center. She's joining me over the phone, and we're discussing meningitis in children. So meningitis is basically the swelling of a protective layer around the brain and spinal cord. That layer is called the meninges. It's caused by primarily pathogens like bacteria or viruses that enter the body. Sometimes it can also be caused by parasites or other non-infectious causes, in some cases like cancers. With the introduction of certain vaccines like Haemophilus influenza B vaccine in 2002 in the National Immunization Schedule in Malaysia, and that has contributed a lot to reducing meningitis from HIB bacteria. But, meningitis is still a concern. It's one of those things that when you're a parent, especially a new parent, every fever is so alarming to you. You know, you're always wondering, is this normal or should I, rush to the hospital? So when it comes to symptoms of meningitis, Dr. Sangeeta, what should parents look out for?
Okay. So generally in children with meningitis, there's always the symptom of having fever. And this fever is usually high grade, as in high fever, more than 38.5. Mm-hmm. In younger children, the symptoms can be a bit more difficult to pick up. It can be very easily missed. And especially in newborns, even newborns or neonates can also have meningitis. And they essentially just present with just fever. So we have to have a very high index of suspicion. A lot of the children also have irritability or basically being very, very cranky. Mm-hmm. Some of them may have poor feeding, refusal to feed, or sleeping more than usual. Sometimes we do hear some of these kids having a very high-pitched cry, and that also could be one of the symptoms which parents have described. Some mm-hmm. of the kids may have seizures, vomiting, and also a bulging fontanelle, which is the soft part of your skull. Sometimes you see it sort of bulging. So in very young infants, and you may see this. In children who are a bit older and who are a bit more verbal, they may complain of extreme sensitivity to light. And, if they prefer to just be in a darker room, and if you were to shine a light in their eyes, they would very quickly shut it. Mm-hmm. Some of them may also have headaches, stiff necks, or seizures. I've had few patients have also actually come in with a bit of confusion. So rarely we've also seen certain meningitis, namely the meningococcal meningitis, which comes in with sort of a rash. Mm-hmm. So these are a few of the symptoms which have been described and which I've also seen in some of my patients. The symptoms don't occur altogether. Sometimes the fever comes first and then followed by the others. Mm-hmm. And sometimes before the meningitis symptoms actually happen, the child may have a respiratory tract symptom, either a bit of cough or flu or some infection in the ear. So that's how the bacteria sort of like travels and, involves the brain. Yeah, that's basically how majority of the kids would present to their doctors.
All right. So is there a useful guide in terms of perhaps how many days of fever is a reason for concern?
As a neurologist, we generally don't use this kind of guides. Like, for example, okay, fever one day, don't be concerned. Fever 5 days, let's be concerned. But basically, we look at any red flag signs. So any child with a febrile illness, and if the child is drinking, if the child is still active, even with fever, there's usually no cause for concern. But with the high fever, the child is inactive, sleeping most of the time, not drinking, not eating, having breathing problems, having a seizure, or having a stiff neck, or the conscious level looks a bit off, doesn't want to look at light, or what we call photophobia, I would call this more dangerous signs, or what we could call red flag signs, and these kids need to be brought in to be assessed immediately.
Immediately, okay.
Another case scenario is many of these kids with fever actually may also have seizures. And these children are usually diagnosed to have febrile seizures. And but the rule of the thumb would be, usually in most of these kids, after the seizure, just say about half an hour or 1 hour after the seizure, the child is able to regain the conscious level, you know, and as a neurologist, when you examine them, there's no other sort of red flag signs to suggest this, these are meningitis. And then we would call these kids febrile seizures. So, but definitely any child with fever and seizures needs an assessment by a healthcare professional.
You know, since you bring up the seizures, another obviously very terrifying thing when it occurs, what should parents do when their child is having a seizure?
Okay. So the first thing is you said that done is do not panic, but there's no parent who wouldn't panic.
Of course.
But always try and remain to stay calm. And then what you should do is try and time the seizure. Look at the clock and see what time we think the seizure happened. And then keep the child safe, move any harmful objects away from the child, and put the child onto their side, especially if they are not aware and awake. Do not block the airway, don't put anything inside the mouth, don't put a spoon, don't put your finger in the mouth, just put the child on the side. Do not restrain their movement, do not try and give any water, medications, or food, or anything, just leave the child on the side. Stay with the child until they are fully awake. Most seizures would end in a few minutes, but a seizure which doesn't end at the fifth minute would be a seizure which won't actually stop spontaneously. So usually these are the seizures which would need a medication to be given, to be administered so that it stops. If it's the first seizure, every child needs to be assessed. But in a few of my patients or with recurrent seizures, most of the parents have what we call a seizure plan. Mm-hmm. So I give them a plan and they know what to do. And even if they come to the ER with a lot of seizures, I even have a seizure plan. Like if this fails, then give this, you know, depending on what's causing the seizure. Mm-hmm. But generally, this is what I basically teach the parents.
What is the danger of missing or ignoring the symptoms that you described above?
So, I mean, of course, if we ignore the symptoms of meningitis, meaning we fail to diagnose it, the infection, because when we suspect someone has meningitis, we would admit the patient, we would quickly start antibiotics. The child would be regularly monitored, you know, the vital signs, the blood pressure, the respiratory rate, the heart rate, and we'll also make sure the child doesn't have a seizure, and we will support all the vital signs. So if we don't do, if we miss the diagnosis, we won't be doing all of what I just described. Mm-hmm. And if we don't do all of what I just described, the infection can become worse. The infection can become more invasive, and you're going to get sort of more complications of the infection, more area of brain involvement, and hence more complications and morbidity and maybe even death. Mm-hmm. So essentially, it's very, very important to pick up the signs so that appropriate treatment can be started.
What are some of the complications of meningitis?
Okay. So a few complications which have been very well described would be vision loss, hearing loss. Some children can also have pus collection in the brain. We call this subdural effusion. Generally, we see this in younger infants. So we would monitor the head circumference, which is the size of the head, and we'll also do ultrasonography on a weekly basis until the child goes back. Mm-hmm. Another complication which can happen would be hydrocephalus, which is an increase in the pressure of the brain. And this would usually be picked up by ultrasounds and even later CT scans. In the long term, so these are all maybe the more acute sort of complications. Mm-hmm. In the long term, children can get conditions which we call cerebral palsy, epilepsy, seizures later, developmental delay, and even death in at least about 10% of children with meningitis.
Mm. And so that comes back to what you were saying earlier, the risk when you miss the signs of meningitis, when you don't immediately bring your child, it's increasing the risk of these long-term complications.
For sure.
Yeah. But coming back to, you know, what would you, and you've talked about the cause of action when the child is presented to you. And you said earlier about a lumbar puncture. Would you need to do that for every child that you suspect of meningitis?
Yes, it's a very important test to do.
Okay.
Of course, when we want to diagnose somebody who has meningitis, I mean, I wouldn't do a lumbar puncture for every child with, for example, a febrile seizure. So it still goes back to the history, the physical examination. And if I suspect this child has meningitis, I would definitely counsel for a lumbar puncture. It's a very important test to do. It's like, you know, when a patient has a urinary tract infection, of course, taking the blood does give some extra information, but you always need to analyze the urine.
Mm-hmm.
The same with a brain infection.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, the blood test would point and would help us in managing, but we always have to analyze the cerebrospinal fluid because that's where the source of the infection is. And from the lumbar puncture, we can always tell whether is this a more bacterial type of meningitis, a more viral type of meningitis, or is it more a tuberculous type of meningitis.
Mm.
So I think that's a very important point. We can also try and grow the bacteria. We've got many tests which we call culture and sensitivity. And nowadays what I do is I send for a meningitis/encephalitis PCR panel,
mm-hmm.
so I would be able to even diagnose other types of viral meningitis, which we couldn't diagnose before because of advancement in the panel.
Mm-hmm.
And I have diagnosed, you know, different types of meningitis like HHV6 meningitis, HHV, different types of other herpes infections, EBV meningitis. So a lot of other different types of infections. So this panel will only be accurate if I get the sample, which is the cerebrospinal fluid sample.
What are parents' concerns, though, with a lumbar puncture?
All right, okay. So I think the main concern is whether the child would be paralyzed.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was also a study which was done. I think this is more of a questionnaire, I think, not a study, more of a questionnaire. And they asked parents what were their concerns. The two top one which came out was paralysis, and surprisingly, the other one was impotence.
Right.
So that are the main concerns. It probably stemmed from belief that, you know, when you put a needle back there, you know, it's going to hit the spinal cord.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not even going near where the spinal cord, and that will, you know, maybe severe it or injure it, and the child will be paralyzed. But we know that even if you don't do a lumbar puncture, and the infection itself can make the child paralyzed. So I think that's how the belief came that, oh, the lumbar puncture caused the paralysis.
I see.
But generally now, I find most parents are being more open-minded with lumbar puncture. I try and use the a few analogies. Like, for example, if a mom went for a C-section, the anesthetist would also give the anesthesia through the same spot. So if the mom delivered the child via a C-section, they would know that, I mean, the mom's not paralyzed, so why should the child be?
Mm-hmm.
So, but in this, I mean, in lumbar puncture, we do not give any medications. We insert the needle at the same site and just take the cerebral spinal fluid for analysis.
Mm.
So when we try to communicate and try and draw diagrams, you know, and sometimes in certain patients, which I really need the parents to agree, I get other parents to speak to them, and I would say I could get a 96% success rate now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's good from maybe 40, 50% before, maybe mm-hmm. 10, 15 years ago.
All right.
So I think most parents are being more receptive to lumbar puncture itself.
And because you say that the lumbar puncture helps you to distinguish between bacterial or viral meningitis,
yeah.
So that's going to influence your decision with treatment.
Definitely.
Yeah. So if you treat a bacterial meningitis with antibiotics, but what about a viral meningitis? What would you do?
Yeah, so generally what we would do is if only certain viruses have treatment, which we give IV acyclovir. So only if... So sometimes what we do is we empirically treat, which means that when the patient comes in with suspected what we call meningoencephalitis, you know, we tend to sort of maybe lump them together, and then we empirically treat with the antibiotics and antiviral.
Mm.
Then we'll do the lumbar puncture and try and get a diagnosis. So if it's the viruses which are able to be treated, then I would continue the antiviral. But if the viral panel is negative, then I will just stop the antiviral.
Okay.
But the child will probably get one or two doses because, I mean, we want to quickly treat brain infection because it's a serious infection. So giving the antibiotic on time is very, very important. So I rather treat first and then wait for the test to come out and then adjust the medication. Either stop or change antibiotics.
I see. Is antibiotic resistance a concern when it comes to treating meningitis?
I must say of course it's always a concern, but I must say in my personal experience, I've not had major problems with it.
Mm-hmm.
I think more doctors now are very careful and judicious in their use of antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, with me, you know, not every fever gets an antibiotic, you know, because viral infections are commoner than bacterial infections.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't sort of do knee-jerk reflex and, you know, first day of fever, let's go for antibiotics. And this sort of practice is also being done by all the other general practitioners, other pediatricians. So I think overall, it seems that people are being very judicious with the usage of antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And parents also are more aware about antibiotic resistance. And, you know, sometimes when the child really needs antibiotics, we also get parents who are like, doctor, no, we don't want antibiotics
yeah.
if the child doesn't need it. And then we need to say, oh, no, your child really needs the antibiotic now because this is a bacterial infection. And mm-hmm. then, you know, they'll be like, okay. But it's good that the parents are questioning, you know, the decision to start or not to start, because it shows that they understand the seriousness of overprescribing antibiotics, which could lead to antibiotic resistance.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about recovery. What is the process for a child's recovery and what kind of outcomes can be expected?
Right. So, and it takes a bit longer for a child to recover from meningitis. I've had patients who have made full recovery back and some not. So it depends on, again, how much complications the child had.
Mm-hmm.
The children who fully recover back usually don't have much brain involvement, so just maybe just infection of the layer, you know, and a bit of the fluid. And generally they can recover back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
But some children who've got more complications, they take longer. So generally we're looking at maybe staying in the hospital for, you know, maybe at least 2 weeks to 3 weeks minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's complications like
pus collection in the brain, like a subdural effusion, then these children would need a referral to the neurosurgeon, and sometimes this fluid needs to be drained out. And then, you know, if the kid also develops hydrocephalus, then this also would need a referral to the neurosurgeon, and you know, they might put a shunt or a way of just sort of diverting the cerebrospinal fluid for a bit. So these kind of kids generally stay a bit longer, maybe 4, 5, maybe 6 weeks. So it actually depends on a case-to-case basis, but generally I would say, you know, we're looking at a recovery or admission between 2 to 3 weeks to maximum of maybe 5 to 6 weeks.
Right. You know, every parent's fear is, you hear these horror stories of children who've had meningitis and then because of the complications, perhaps they were paralyzed after that. You know, how and we hear these stories, we don't really know how common they are. You know, is it on the increase or actually on the decrease?
Actually, overall, I would say, you know, because of immunization, our incidence of meningitis has come down. Mm-hmm. And pneumococcal vaccine was the vaccine which was lacking in the national immunization schedule. But come 2020, the government of Malaysia was going to start it as a part of the routine vaccines.
Yeah.
But COVID-19 came, and I think these plans were sort of disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
But any child who was born in the year 2020 would get a pneumococcal vaccine as part of the national immunization schedule.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of parents have gotten this vaccine either in the private setup, so either they go to the general pediatrician or to the GP clinics and they get this vaccine. So I would say because of good vaccination practices,
mm-hmm.
I think the incidence overall has come down. It's not as severe as, it's not as high as it was before.
Mm-hmm.
And I anticipate it to come down further with the inclusion, you know, when this pneumococcal vaccine is more widely available to even children from the lower socioeconomic strata. So mm-hmm. I suspect and I hope that incidence will become lower in the near future.
And what else can we do to prevent the transmission of the other pathogens that are not covered by vaccination, especially viruses that cause meningitis?
Right. So same, I mean, I guess same for any sort of, you know, infection. So always ensure good hygiene. And we know most of this infection starts with, and it starts in the respiratory tract. So there'll be some cough and, you know, so having good cough etiquette. I mean, sometimes with children, it's not easy,
mm-hmm.
but it's good to always teach our children how to cough. So either cough in your sleeve, you know, close your mouth when you cough. So with generally teach kids that even at a young age.
Mm-hmm.
Children who can wear a mask when, you know, if they're sick and, you know, if they need, I mean, if you're sick, don't send your kid to school. Don't send your kid to the nursery. Keep your child at home. And if you utterly need to go out, then always wear a mask, you know, if you can. Strict hand washing is also very important. And always stay healthy. Good diet, adequate nutrition for children, and definitely making sure that the immunization is on schedule.
Mm. I think if nothing else, COVID-19 has taught us about a lot of those basic practices, yeah?
For sure,
hand washing and etiquette and protecting ourselves.
For sure. I've seen patients as young as, 2 years old who even know how to wash their hands so well, because whenever they come in, I will just squirt some hand rub on your hands, and
mm-hmm.
wow, you'll be so surprised on how they actually know the steps. So kudos to the parents who actually, you know, make an effort to teach the kids how to properly wash hands. Yeah. And I think that's a good thing. And these habits must be inculcated at a very young age so that it becomes habit even when they grow older.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a final message for us, Dr. Sangeeta?
Yeah, so my final message would be not every child with fever and seizures is meningitis. meningitis is a very serious condition. So if there's any of the red flag signs which I mentioned, please seek help a professional urgently. Please make sure your child gets the vaccines as per schedule. And stay safe, everyone.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sangeeta. I've been speaking to Dr. Sangeeta Terumale, consultant pediatrician and neurologist from Subang Jaya Medical Center. And if you missed any part of this conversation, especially where Dr. Sangeeta talked about the symptoms of meningitis, you can download the podcast on our website, bfm.my, or on our BFM app. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.